At the third stroke, it will be...
Hello and welcome to EUC Digest, your audio snack on everything EUC related. In today's show, we'll be talking to a true EUC veteran about his view on EUC in general, and of course, also on the changes in workspace management. But before we dive into this, the wonders of EUC and the workspace management, please allow us to introduce ourselves. My name is Jits Langerijk, and I'm your host for this episode. And with me today is Ingmar Verhey. Hey, Ingmar, how are you doing?
Hey, Jits. Hey, yeah, doing well, doing great. Actually, I'm doing really great. Crazy times. I kept my haircut last week since 106 days. So I'm super happy. Appreciating all the little things in life, and getting my haircut is just, it's just wonderful.
Yeah, I saw on social that it was actually like a sheep experience, right? In the spring when they get their cut.
Yeah, I assume you had a video cast on that because it was springing around, jumping around like that. Yeah, exactly.
Ah.
Experience.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. So, yeah, but before we move on and introduce a special guest for today, let's take the opportunity to say thank you to our sponsor, Liquidware. So, as you all know and frequent listeners to this podcast, Liquidware provides adaptive workspace management solutions for all Windows desktops. The company includes all facets of management to ensure the ultimate user experience across all workspaces, whether it's physical, virtual desks, or in the cloud. So thank you very much, Liquidware. And so let's go over to our special guest. But Ingmar, before we do so, did you find out any interesting facts about our guest today?
I sure did. It was obviously, you know, for every recording, we do our due diligence. So we try to figure out, like, who are we interviewing here? So did you know that one of his first ventures was a trolley shuttle bus in the Outlet Malls? And I'm not sure if this is related, but he's a keen rally driver. And today's guest can be introduced with the quote, "Never let anyone know what you're thinking," which is from Al Pacino in The Godfather. But today he will be sharing some thoughts for sure. And did you know it was love at first sight at the moment he visited our nation's capital, Amsterdam? And that he goes by the name of T-Rex, a name given to him by his daughter. And this wasn't based on his presumably steak preference, but instead related to his arms.
Oh, really? So, yeah.
Well, there's a lot to jump into there. Wow. I guess I'll take the first bite. Well, I'll start with the thing that I really enjoy, which is rally car racing. So, yes, I do have an affinity for driving slow cars fast, which is much more fun than driving fast cars slow, if you've ever tried that. And after running out of talent 3 or 4 times and putting that car into a nice ball of trees, I retired from the sport of rally car racing. But I have to also say, you know, hearing all these challenges you have with your haircuts, you know, as a slightly balding 50-year-old man, it's kind of hard for me to feel bad for you. Unless, of course, you save some and you are offering, you know, wigs or toupees or these types of things.
Oh, sure. Yeah, but absolutely. No worries. We can ship it at a decent price. No, we're happy to share.
Yeah, so welcome, Tyler. And for those who do not recognize your voice or didn't recognize any of the hints or the clues that we provided. So your name is Tyler, right? Tyler Rohrer or T-Rex. So
welcome right,
to the
show. J. Tyler T-Rex Rohrer the First. It's a long story, a teeny bit boring how I got the nickname, but it was bestowed upon me by my daughter. So it had to stick for those, I guess, 11 years that we just went through. But, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, I guess I was taught at an early age, if you're going to be, slightly balding and short, you better have a memorable nickname. And so I guess T-Rex has served me well for a decade plus. But, yeah, I'm the co-founder of Liquidware, and so super excited to be here and talk to both of you. Certainly a ton of things have changed in the end-user computing, you know, world, and I guess I'm just lucky to have had a front row seat and made a lot of the mistakes early. And so here to share all the lessons learned and hopefully some detours and shortcuts, kind of using a rally analogy to keep you out of the trees.
Looking forward to that, yeah.
Yeah, well, and actually, as you mentioned, making some of the mistakes really early, maybe really early in your career, or at least you made them before we did. But that reminds me of one of the quotes in one of your blog articles on Forbes, where you said, well, one of the methodologies is fail fast and learn from your mistakes. So I, especially working at NVIDIA, really like that, because that's one of our mottos as well, right? So that's what our CEO always mentioned, fail fast and adapt and share the failures with each other. So we can,
absolutely,
as you say, keep them out of the trees.
Well, that's a great quote I heard once from, I guess it was one of the lead engineers at Google, and somebody had put to him, the question, you know, how does Google innovate at such a rapid pace? And he says, well, it's simple. We make decisions incredibly quickly, but when they're the wrong ones, we unmake them incredibly quickly. And you'd be surprised how many companies just get, fall in love with bad ideas, you know, and I think that companies like NVIDIA are examples of being at the forefront of being willing to iterate, being willing to fail fast, and the results speak for themselves. I mean, I think that if anyone's pushing the limits of Moore's laws, you folks and what you're doing, which I'm also fascinated with for, you know, AI applications and machine learning. Well, that's a different show for a different day.
Yeah, definitely. But the interesting part, or the most challenging part, is, of course, not to failing fast, that's easy, right? But to drop the failing decisions really quickly, that's the most challenging part there, right? So usually there's a lot of emotion involved. You're carrying your little child, maybe, or your idea, and then to give up on it, that can be challenging.
It sure can. You know, it's one of the reasons I kind of fell in love with your homeland. You mentioned my love of Amsterdam within probably 24 hours. The authenticity of the people, your ideas, the history, you know, of your country, it's palpable. You can feel it. And so I love getting over there. I straight up think that it's one of the core bastions of end user computing. You've got some amazing thought leaders over there, obviously present company included. So yeah, no, I'm just excited to be a part of the conversation and, you know, add my page or two. So here to ask or here to answer any questions that I might be able to help with.
Yeah. So, maybe we can start with this one. Tyler, can you tell us a little bit about the man behind the name? Like, how did you get started? How did you get into IT especially? I mean, obviously, you were born at some day and a lot of things happened, but what made you go into, you know, this computer business?
It's a detour or a wrong term, but I'll tell you the story. So, as you mentioned, I had been an entrepreneur since an early age. And so a couple of my first ventures had great success, and I ended up selling that trolley shuttle bus business and, you know, made a little bit of money in the process. And so I became a stockbroker, which is what I thought you did. You know, when you had a little bit of capital, you know, you invest in the stock market and see if you can make it into more. And then hopefully, you know, you make other people money too, but, you know, that's secondary. So one day a customer came and I said, you know, what exactly is it that you folks do across the river? You have 25-year-old employees coming in. They're dropping off thousands of dollars with me a month, you know, biweekly to invest in the stock market. You know, what exactly are you up to? And he said, well, we're a technology reseller. You should come work for us. And I said, oh, I can't sell used computers. And he said, no, that's not what a reseller does. And so he explained to me how manufacturers get products to distribution, get products out to channel and system integrators, and then obviously a solution is delivered to a customer. I said, okay, that sounds pretty cool. You know, let me go try this. And really, I call it a detour because, you know, I was probably the last person on the world that you would have thought would have been, you know, technically inclined. And yet, you know, once I learned about SCSI drives and IRQ interrupts, the rest is history.
For
the old serial port guys in the old days. I know you USB folks, you might not remember that kind of IRQ interrupts.
Unfortunately, I had to learn IRQ just because being 40-year-old, these are the things you have to learn. I like that you said you're an entrepreneur. That's actually a question I have for you. Like, were you a born entrepreneur? Or is this something that, you know, you can learn? I mean, you obviously had to take a year off, in quotes, that's what you said on your LinkedIn. And we alluded to this already before the recording, but this is something I can learn. Can someone learn to become an entrepreneur, or is it just you have to be an entrepreneur and then it happens?
No, I think that's a great question. I would have answered it a different way before. And so I'll give you the different way before. I would have said that, no, you know, you've got to be born with it. It's in your DNA. It takes a rare breed. And, you know, only a very few, you know, probably have the mustard to be an entrepreneur. But I would give you a different answer today. The answer I would give you today is I believe entrepreneurship is born out of necessity. I think that whatever it is, that you want or need or desire or you know, hope to fix or hope to complete in your life. It's that drive, that necessity that will give you the momentum you need to be a successful entrepreneur versus, you know, I think some eminent domain that you're just born with. But I used to think that, you know, think, oh gosh, this is tough stuff. And, you know, you'd have to be nuts to do it. I also thought that perhaps being a troublemaker was part of the equation. I had a little bit of challenge growing up with authority figures and staying in colleges and staying in dorm rooms and these types of things without being asked to take some time off. So, you know, I think the rebellious streak, maybe a curiosity mixed with necessity. I think in some way that's at least a good starting formula. And then so many details around the periphery, and the least of which is certainly surround yourself with a team. Because if it's a solo mission, you're not an entrepreneur, or you're a hero. That's a different story altogether.
Yeah, and that's good to hear. So I think, I mean, what you said about the Dutch, I think Dutch would make good entrepreneurs. We don't accept a lot of authority, and we always have different ideas. So maybe that's maybe at some point we should start a venture. It's beyond this one.
Well, there's a pride and a passion in your belief, I found. I mean, I've only spent a week or so in your country, so don't pretend to know anything more than what I observe. But you know, I guess from knowing, you know, folks over the decades, a pride in your passion is also important. Does that make sense? Does that translate?
No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and actually, you know, Jits and I, we both work for a global company. You have Dutch employees. I think it's a pro and a con the way the Dutch, you know, our attitude is, right? We like to have an opinion, and even if you don't ask for it, we'll give it to you regardless. That's kind of what we do. So yes, this is a passion. I also learned along the way that sometimes it's a bit too much, but in the core, I would say, yeah, I think I think we have a good attitude here, being Dutch. Yeah.
Well, I also I heard a quote recently, which is, if you don't have a plan, you're going to become part of somebody else's plan. And the one thing I've always admired about the new folks is that you march to the beat of your own drummer. You have a plan, right or wrong. It's at least a commitment and a belief. And quite frankly, I think historically, you've been on the right side of history a lot more times than wrong.
Yeah.
Definitely right. So, and you mentioned this already, right? Especially, you refer to the Dutch in the community, and I think that's the community in general, right? Whether that's, software-defined networking or in our case, end-user computing, right? But if you look more towards end-user computing, why is it that, when I do my due diligence online on you, it's all about end-user computing, right? So sure. What's this passion or what's this focus? Is this something that you just, stumbled upon, or is this a particular domain that you focused on because of?
Yeah, great segues, and I can kind of take it into a couple different directions. I would say the first, at least personally for me, the love or the interest in end user computing was really born out of a love of physics. You know, in college, I took business classes until I decided that I really was more interested in physics, and they said, "Well, it's too late. You're a businessman now. Here's a book or two you can read on the side." And what really fascinated me, and of course, it's one of the things that fascinates me about NVIDIA, you know, was the early days of computer systems, the early days of computer networking, the early days of multiprocessor innovation, call it Moore's Law, really led to a problem of scale. Well, it led to a benefit of scale, which is everyone had technology, but then it led to a problem of scale, which was it got away from us, you know, and we really didn't have proper management, you know, platforms to kind of reel that scale back in. So I guess my interest primarily in end user computing was, can we figure out a way to get scale to work for us again? Can I do something once and have it affect, you know, tens of thousands of users? I mean, these are just questions that I had, you know. And so the interesting thing was, you know, around the time of 2007, around the time of VDI, it was an interesting time in the market where you had virtualization, kind of a unique moment in Moore's Law and end user computing, where, you know, processors and memory had gotten, you know, way far ahead of any application. I mean, you didn't need 16 cores, you know, to run PowerPoint, at least maybe I don't. But the point is that these convergence of these different technologies, and then of course adding cloud, it was the perfect time, you know, to kind of lean in. And so I guess you could say early days of the internet, I guess, were the early days of cloud. But you saw how that rich and robust local processing mixed with these network services had some kind of future that, at least to me, said how we might be able to manage this all. So I don't, here I am still trying, you know, 30 years later.
No, but
still trying to manage and give the right end user experience. I think, I'm not sure if that's the same for you, Tyler, but with all this technology you said, it started with, you know, with the processor stuff at the desk of an end user, and it always got pulled back into an IT infrastructure. Like now it's VDI, it's been run by an IT environment. With cloud, it goes into a cloud provider's environment. End user computing, to me, the end user management solutions that you have and others as well, it makes it better, right? It makes it so in such a way so that for the end user, it's get optimized, it get, I lost my brain of thought here.
It increases the user experience or the
exactly.
productivity or
exactly.
it's easier to achieve our goals.
Is it?
Right? IT is just a tool to most of us, or I think to all of us, right? So, and you need to provide a saw and a hammer to a carpenter in the easiest way, right? And well, for others, it's just PowerPoint or any other application. PowerPoint probably not the best example. But you mentioned virtualization, right? So,
sure.
And I was thinking, you've been in the industry, and as we said in the introduction, a true EUC veteran. You've seen many changes throughout the years, and also I saw one quote. At least you quoted Bill Joy from Sun Microsystems, and you said radical change usually comes about through a series of gentle nudges. So these gentle nudges, maybe that's virtualization, maybe that's VDI. But can you name a couple of big game changers in these?
Oh, really? Absolutely. So, yeah. No, this is a great segue. Thank you for bringing this up and great for finding that quote. Bill Joy is, I guess, in some ways my spirit animal in terms of what he was able to accomplish. What he meant by that quote, I think, was, you know, it took Moore's Law. It took the proliferation of cheap and powerful devices. It then took virtualization. It then took better networking. It then took some breaches, which led us to security. It then took some storms, which led us to realize that pandemics might happen. And then today, a pandemic actually had to happen for us all to realize, like, wait a second, perhaps handing a device to a person with a lot of state in it isn't the best model moving forward, right? But you couldn't have said that 10 years ago. People would say, what are you talking about? I mean, it's so integrated. All the parts work together. You know, the chip works with the hard drive, works with the operating system, works with the apps and the profile. It's perfect. Don't mess with it. You know, except for it was a landlocked, you know, pile of risk made by the lowest cost bidder, typically in a, you know, in a factory without a lot of oversight. So I guess my fascination came from the point is, okay, what of those parts, if orchestrated correctly, you know, could get us to that problem statement, which is, can you manage all this just a little bit easier? And I love how both of you both said it, and I haven't keyed in on it yet, user experience. I mean, if we're not improving the user experience, therefore the productivity of these end users, we're wasting everyone's time. You know, I mean, the enchantment with technology for technology's sake, I'm guilty, as guilty of it as anyone. But I guess I'm here to be the canary in the coal mine and warn you, you know, that if it can't lead to that productivity gains on the part of, you know, you, I think it's actually three stakeholders. The end user has to be more productive. I think IT, your staff, has to be more productive with whatever new tool you bring in. But then your budget, you know, I mean, if it costs 10X and you're only getting 3X benefit, then sorry, you're rowing against the tide. Does that make sense? You know, so I think going back to your question about IT, it all has to be orchestrated. And I think that's where it begins.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to improve your competitive advantage, then, you know, cost has to be in line with the expenses you do. And I also like the quote around nudges. I think the gentle nudges come from many angles. And I think, especially these days, the more and more that come from the employees itself, the users. And unfortunately, it took the pandemic to realize a lot of things. But I think by now, one of the gentle nudges is like, you know, sorry, organization, you don't dictate what I get to do. It's the end user. We talked about consumerization of IT for a while.
Oh, I'm glad you said that. Yeah,
got laughed away. But solutions like you provide as well, they enable those things, right? to really like.
Well, the consumerization is an interesting angle for me, and I'll tell you why. You know, I think for me it leads to one word, which is expectations, which is, you know, when I think about a telephone, you know, we're old enough to remember, you know, telephones, pre-cell phone, you picked it up, it always worked. I mean, just maybe in a horrible storm, the end of the earth, you know, you wouldn't have a dial tone. But the ability to have a dial tone was almost a given. I think we need to get there for computing services. You know, I don't know if it's a PC or Windows or an edge operating system, some really cool stuff being done with Eagle and some of the these edge operating system companies. But what I mean by that is, you know, you have to push through some of these large walls first and say, okay, if I could just get to that dial tone, then for a user and user experience, that's a service they could consume. You know, but I think to get to that, or maybe it's a start menu for us, you know, to get to that clean Windows start menu, what do I have to put together to get there? So anyway, it's so many different, I guess, models and architectures.
Yeah, as you said, Tyler, maybe we need to push through a wall. But what are the walls in today's EUC world? What is it that we need to solve now, right? So you have lots and lots of experience in EUC, and you've seen all these gentle nudges and exchanges in order to get a better user experience, higher productivity, or satisfaction maybe out of an EUC environment.
Let's start simple. When was the last time you picked up your cell phone, clicked on an application, and it didn't work? I can't remember. I mean, maybe it's happened to me in the last year. I mean, I think about how many times that happens to me at work. Well, not here at Liquidware, but, you know, outside of the modern enterprise, it's a challenge. You know, so it's something that might seem so simple, but if you cannot open that app, then you cannot do the job that I'm paying you to do. And it might be you or you and 20 of your coworkers. You know, how do you even calculate that loss of productivity? I mean, that's a zero. You know, somebody told me once, there's really only two things. Either people are either revenue contributors or they're you know, a cost center that are helping support, you know, the revenue contribution of a company. And so I really think, and here's something I've been guilty of. I've thought a lot about, you know, the back office workers and how to get that TCO ROI done. But no, now I'm even thinking about how do we take this technology and make a revenue producer more efficient? Can they do business with more stakeholders or add value to more patients? You know what I'm saying? Not just money, it's the service that's being offered. And so I think that's one of the most exciting things about where I see this going. Yes, I think we get user experience headed in the right direction where that expectation of a productive environment is there. When I pick up or log in, I don't worry about double clicking an app and not having it load because, I mean, someone else deals with that. We're not there yet, you know, but I think we're getting closer.
But maybe just to follow up on that, I was saving this question, to be honest, but in one of your articles I was reading about, it was the article, what steps should be taken to deliver the workspace of tomorrow, right? And there you give three pointers or three key areas where to focus. And it starts with understand with what you have and then followed with rethink your environment. And last but certainly not least, monitor and maintain new additions, of course. And they all make sense, but maybe, and that's the same as you mentioned before, right? You need accessibility to an application and it needs to work whenever you want it, right? Because this is what we experience as a consumer. However, and this is just my observation, right? So it doesn't start with applications or technology, right? It's about people and process, and technology is, as I said earlier, it's just a tool. So do we need to rethink the way we consume applications, or do we completely need to rethink how we deliver applications to an end user? Maybe Neuralink is again the same topic here, right?
I've got to say yes. So, I mean, now you've got me thinking about the future, or at least you've opened up that door, so I will proudly walk right through it. So I think you're right. I think that if we're being honest with ourselves, you know, we have to be willing to accept a completely new models. And you know, I like things like, why do I even log in? I mean, shouldn't the machine know when I get out of my Tesla car, breach in infrared security gateway into an office building, and should have my apps be pre-warmed, all the caches heated up, and I'm ready to go? I mean, well, why not? It's free, and it takes no talent to code that. Why are we not doing that, right? We're fixing the small stuff first. But I'm with you entirely. You know, you fast forward the movie to things like Neuralink. what happens when there is an anticipation on a part of the workspace, you know, based on X factor, you know, that Tyler's going through, either my work schedule, my diet change, my boss is up to a new task, a new idea, you know, and those things right now, I think we still are challenged to, you know, relegate those into text. We put them into documents and then we either consume or create new documents around that. But I think you're onto something. I think the future is, you know, unleashing human potential. I mean, that's what we've always been doing, right? We're a tool making species. We make tools. No other animals do this. Well, I mean, the warblers, I think, dig for worms with a stick. But aside from that, we're really the only tool makers or solution makers, you know? And so that's one of the things I've told people about Liquidware. Yeah, we're a solutions company. I mean, we make solutions that attempt to amplify things you're trying to already fix or get better as you work, you know, at scale and end user computing. You know, so we have three products that do that. I believe the future will focus not only on the technical architectural attributes, but, you know, what else can I amplify about you? I mean, what is it that makes you two so special, the intellectual property in your head? And instead of waiting for you to type that out, I should know that. You know, I should be able to work with that, collaborate with that, and wait for you live. That's the good stuff. But, you know, the stuff you've already said, like, it's cool. You could pull up all these quotes about me. What if that was actually a body of knowledge that went into the way we process things? I don't know. These are the dreams of a short, bald guy from Maine in the United States.
So, Tyler, now with technologies coming in like Microsoft Teams, Google Workspace, basically it's in, you know, they're meant SaaS applications. Those are digital experience workspaces. Why do we still need VDI? What's the future of EUC, you think?
Oh, two great questions wrapped up into one. I'll dive in and kind of answer it in the following way. I think, you know, too often, and perhaps this is a personal critique, I get enchanted with technology for technology's sake versus thinking about what problem is it that I'm actually trying to solve and does the technology that's in front of me have a chance to solve that? VDI was a teeny bit like that. You know, we kind of all heard about the idea of running a Windows operating system on a hypervisor. And, you know, I think it became an enchantment. I have joked around in the past and said that VDI stands for very distracting idea. Reason I say that, not only because my first boss at VMware came up with the term VDI, but also because I think if you're trying to solve something like printing, VDI might not be what you need. Now, alternatively, I also do give myself, and I think a lot of us in the industry, a lot of leeway when it comes to defining VDI. I personally think that while I can criticize it being distracting, I also realize that some components of what I consider to be VDI are critical. I'll give you some examples, and you hit on a few. SaaS, as a service, applications as a service. We need applications. That's what we all use to create or consume content. Maybe you don't need VDI. Maybe you just need something as a service. Maybe it's an app. Let's move on. You create documents. You edit documents. Perhaps you don't need VDI. We simply need to back those up better, make those more available to the other devices that you carry around. Maybe they're Windows and Linux or, you know, edge operating systems. And so I believe that, you know, again, it's a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, but with a wide definition of VDI, recognizing that, you know, it's virtualization of apps and data and the user and the network and the machine and the login and admin rights. I mean, you really can talk about abstracting a lot of these things, that there are bits and pieces of those that will help solve real problems for people today without necessarily having to go architect a VDI stack from, you know, 1 to 100. That's just what I've seen. Although I hear myself saying that, and I could also point to some great successful VDI projects that could be the future, you know, of end user computing. So I guess I would answer your question by saying it's writing itself now. I think it's really cool. It's you thought leaders, it's your listeners. It's the stakeholders that help make customers successful. We're writing the pages of the book now. No one's read it yet. I mean, we're literally writing it as we speak. COVID, that was an unforeseen chapter, but here we are, you know, and so I think it'll be interesting 2 to 3 years from now to look back at what we all wrote. What did we all do? How do we use these technologies we had at our fingertips to solve real problems? So hopefully I wasn't too nostalgic, but that's the way I think about the future by looking back, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It's always important to look back, right? You need to know where you're coming from in order to know where you're heading, right? And especially you mentioned COVID, of course. So many organizations not really well transitioning into a new world where they consume applications in a different way. Mm. Well, VDI for sure was whether that's on premises or a as a service offering, desktop as a service from any cloud offering. Well, it was kind of a solution for many organizations just to ramp up their production really quick after, the pandemic all hit up.
We saw it all over the world. We really did. I call it the flinch. It's kind of what I guess you would expect. I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but your segue is perfect, which is we saw a lot of companies flinch, run out, purchase, you know, a laptop or a hardware solution. For the most part, it was a hardware solution. You know, and that kind of got them by for maybe for 6 months, maybe the first year. And yet here we are now. And I think, you know, we have our fingers crossed that things keep working every day. But I think we know that there needs to be some more strategic planning. You know, that the flinches, we survived, most of us, well, hopefully fortunate. And if not, we should help those that didn't. But the point is that kind of like Google Maps, I think we go back to the beginning of, I guess I'll go back to the beginning of VDI when people were saying, well, it sounds really interesting. How do you begin? It was this notion of an assessment. It was this notion of kind of like Google Maps. It's great to get turn by turn directions, but they're meaningless if you don't know where you're starting from. You know, if you don't know where you are today, I call it both your configuration posture, but your usage posture, meaning, you know, not only what does every machine on the network look like and how is it configured and how many hard drives and how much RAM, but what do people actually do? Because that's where the magic is. I can share story after story about horribly over-provisioned machines where, you know, I think today in the modern world, we might actually be able to optimize some of those things. So
innovation
never stops.
Yeah, I wonder if at some point we're going to look back and say, hey, this was the inflection point where we made, you know, rethink VDI as we see, or, you know, basically presentation virtualization. That's what we're doing. It's just an abstraction layer between compute and what we present. Because when we talk about SaaS, I mean, it's consuming a product or software as a service. And I was almost hoping that when we were started talking about DaaS or desktop as a service, like, okay, this is going to change the game. And so far it's only been, well, you still get the same result, except it now runs in a data center of a cloud hoster. I was always hoping, I'm still hoping that when I say, hey, I need access to this SaaS application, that it actually maybe runs on a VDI environment in the back end. I don't care.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like you shouldn't care. I mean, I you know, people jokingly say you don't want to know how a lot of, you know, the sausage is made. The sausage factory tends to be a somewhat ugly process. What I can share with you, and I think you are incredibly astute in that observation, you know, is while a lot of us did, you know, have that flinch in and around, you know, what to do and how to triage it, you know, a lot of solutions did, you know, burst up and across the cloud. And quite frankly, you know, I'm a simple person, but if what you're doing is working, do more of it. And if it's not, do less of it. And I wanted to hit on one word you just mentioned, which is a brilliant word, which is that notion of inflection point. Personally, for me, it happened a little over a year ago. For me, it was when Microsoft and kind of WVD first, you know, had its Hello World, you know, coming out party. Because to me, what that signaled was a willingness on the part of Microsoft to untether the runtime, the operating system from landlocked hardware on the edge, right? And that sounds like a complex way to say it, but basically I feel like Microsoft gave us all permission to reimagine how we could use that operating system that they've been delivering for 25 years. And I think the cool thing is there's a lot of really neat new models, SaaS, DaaS. And to your point, Mark, I want to click on something and be productive for my boss or my company or my stakeholder or my patient or my customer. I don't want to click a button and go, okay, let's see, what was the architecture again? That's right, little Nutanix followed by some WVD using Citrix backed up by Frame, you know, with some OneDrive, you know, being synced with Dropbox. Okay, congratulations. What problem did you solve other than spend a lot of money and make a very, very complex PowerPoint architecture slide?
So I like what you said on the inflection point and WVD and Microsoft. I like the positive spin you give to it, but isn't just like a vendor lock-in by Microsoft. Hey, here's our operating system. If you want multi-user, it's Azure only. I mean, I see this as like, obviously, you know, Yitz and I, we're from the EU. I see potential issues where, I mean, it's a lock-in. What if you want to run on AWS and I want multi-user?
Fair, absolutely fair points. And you know, there's, I think, maybe a few different ways that the model could play itself out. I agree. I think that to Microsoft's credit, what I've seen them do, at least over my 25-year career, is often signal to markets, you know, hey, this is what a Microsoft phone should look like. Now, I think history would show us they didn't get that entirely right. But there have been other examples where, you know, they've said, listen, you know, here's a platform or a standard that we aspire to. Please create an ecosystem of value to help us deliver it. I think you're onto something really, really interesting because, you know, time will tell. From a lock-in perspective, yeah, owning the operating system, a big cloud, having incentives to run your workloads there, that's compelling. But so is innovation, right? And so what's coming next? Who is the smart young girl or guy in their garage inventing the next iteration of application or workspace or jump pad delivery? I don't even know what we'll call it. And here's the second part of the way I would answer your question, Mark. Maybe we democratize it from the standpoint that wouldn't it be interesting if you had the elastic freedom during a runtime session to migrate to another cloud because the quality of service wasn't what you wanted. The cost wasn't what you wanted. Much like if we sit down at a restaurant and the waitress or the waiter isn't exceptional, we can always get up and go to another one. So I'm with you. I think that we're not there yet, but as the platforms evolve and mature, I think there will be some elasticity in our ability. There should be some elasticity in our ability to move across them. I actually heard someone use a term. I don't know if it'll stick. Optimum workload placement. The system should be smart enough to know based on, you know, what Jits or Ingmar wants or needs or has coming up. Where do I put your workload? How do I configure you? Again, I don't want to know how you do it. Just make it work. You know, like my phone, just make it work.
Hey, Tyler, so this sounds like a very... Okay. Yeah.
No, but just a thought, right? In order to provide those advices to an end user or to an organization, I can see some, maybe we're shifting a little bit gears here, but, or maybe just me in my head, but you need some tooling, some measuring tooling. You need a lot of input or in terms of data. Can you share some more on this particular idea and maybe also how this would fit in an ideal world into the offerings from Liquidware, maybe? Just thinking out loud here.
Oh, I appreciate that. No, thank you so much. And I mean, so I'd be happy to kind of answer it slightly in the context from maybe a Liquidware perspective. I think we've long said that, you know, good data helps you make good decisions. Actually, it actually helps you avoid bad decisions. But if you can measure something, you can manage it. And so, you know, from the beginning, I think we've been huge fans in instrumentality that gives you visibility. No matter what you're doing, whether it's you know, delivering cloud-hosted desktops, VDI at scale, using expensive solid-state drives made by NetApp on top of HP, whatever the configuration is, you should care about its performance. And so a great way to validate that is, you know, solutions, for example, like our Stratosphere UX. We've found that well-performing projects get bigger quicker. Well, what leads to that? We've found that it's the elimination of risk. There's nothing that we've found yet that is as successful in minimizing risk as the math. Again, you know, when you're able to watch an environment either from a initial provisioning state as you add users and add applications, and you can look and model the performance and really the key, we can say performance, it's kind of a cop-out word. You guys will probably like this. I'm about user experience. I don't care what the computer system thinks it's got for resources and how happy it is. I want to know what the user account is feeling, right? How are your apps launching? How are you able to retrieve and maybe save documents? So again, in the context of Liquidware, one of the things that does have me encouraged is we are seeing an absolute renaissance in the part of customers and prospective customers, the stakeholders that we work with around the world, and NVIDIA not being the least of which is beautiful, what we're able to get in terms of graphics metrics. But those count. You know, you have to be able to do the math. I think maybe growing up in grade school, I used to have an apprehension for mathematics until I realized it's kind of the language of science. And so you're going to be, very troubled to describe the natural world around you without it. And so, you know, for us, the risk of all of these new deployments, of these architectures, of even deciding what vendor you might want to even tempt being locked in by or with, you know, comes back to the math. It comes back to what problem are you trying to solve, and does the math prove that you're either solving it or missing it? And it's okay that a lot of us flinched and maybe didn't do that work. We're now seeing that, you know, kind of as a phase two, if you will, getting back to normal or trying to. Hopefully that answered your question. I also took a long detour to get to it.
Well, you hit on a lot of things, which basically led to more questions. So I think we'll be sitting here for a long time, Tyler. What I really like you saying is that you are, you know, you can basically eliminate risk by giving visibility, right? You can see what the performance is, the end user performance. How would you say this helps those customers? Obviously, when you run this on-prem, then you can deploy your agents. You can track a lot of, let's say, computational performance, like IOPS, CPU, memory, all these great fancy things. But once you go to a cloud service, so as a service, that's already you saying like, hey, you know what? I don't care how you're going to do it, but I get a contract with you. I get a service. I pay a premium fee for that. What's then the role of Stratosphere? How can you add value on an environment which you maybe not be able to monitor?
I'm glad you asked. So I love that you use the term service level, because I think that's the first place I want to stop. What service level have you been expected to receive, or do you expect to receive based on whoever you signed up to do business with? So if you're on AWS, if you're in Azure, if you're in Google Cloud, if you're on-prem, what is that service level that either the vendor or maybe even, we don't think about this a lot, internal IT. What did internal IT give you as a service level that you could reasonably expect as a line of business? That's number one. Number two, how do I ensure that service level is being met? One of our very large and more successful OEM relationships, unfortunately, I can't mention the platform, but they are in the computer making business. And it was in regards to helping validate 6 million managed service customers were receiving the SLA that was promised. I mean, it was a simple task, but it was a very powerful one, because, you know, the agreement when you go to someone's cloud is that of trust as well. I'm going to give you the following service level. You're going to pay me for it. And to your point, Ingmar, by the way, it's kind of hard to leave me if I don't meet the estimates that I gave you today. Tomorrow, I think it will be even easier. I think that analysis of your service level agreement kind of gives way to that notion of TCO ROI. Well, how much does this cost me? And kind of what's my return on investment? You know, so it's almost as if the early days of technical architecture have now added another module, which is almost financial architecture. I mean, let's get complex, right? So on top of just, will this all work? Now we're going to add, will it all work at a fair price? And I don't think we're there yet. Meaning, I think we are just now at the very early stages of figuring out some of these cost models. The good news is the math helps. The best way to figure out your total cost of ownership is, what do you own? And in cloud, it's not always well defined. You know, do you own the storage? Do you own the network? Do you own the apps?
Maybe. And I think it's good that we're not there yet. That gives us a job for the next decade, probably. So hooray for us. But I guess, you know, having the metrics and the math also helps in holding accountable. Like, hey, this is the service we agreed on. This is the metrics that we have. And, you know, let's see where we can find each other in the middle. But when I heard you say, you know, a service level and if it's being met, we've seen a trend in the market. We used to call this, what's it called again? I can't even remember.
Drift. Anymore.
I wanted to say, you know, can we make this as a self-service thing? We see more gig workers, right? So it's great that an IT department or an organization can measure and say, ah, damn it, we went to this random SaaS or DAS or whatever as a service. We didn't hit the numbers that we agreed on, but let's hide it from the user. And especially with gig economy, you know, people working independently, can you... Consumerization of IT. That's the word I was looking for. It's been 5 years that we mentioned that one. How can you help us? I mean, Tyler, how are you going to help us? You know, us independent employees, help us, please.
Yeah. Yeah, no. So from an independent, it's a great segue into a much larger topic, which is this. I go back to that notion of elasticity, which is, you know, whether it's a gig I sign up to do or a job that I, you know, commit to taking or having for a number of years, you know, the expectation, well, there's expectation on both parts. And so, you know, how do you go ahead, you know, and validate that? You know, I think, you know, from a monitoring perspective, you know, it's probably the most assured way. But I want to make sure I can repeat the question kind of in the context of end user computing. Jiz, I know you've got your head up. You're like,
Yeah, hold on. Because I was just, let me think out loud here, right? So
please do.
Of course, whenever you're talking about a service level agreement, you can agree on certain key performance indicators that are easy to met. Those are smart, right? You can measure those. And then there is a completely different thing when it comes to user experience. This is very subjective. Mm. It's the perceived user experience from an end user, maybe from the gig worker, right? So,
great point.
Those are two different things. In my opinion. So, whenever I close a Teams meeting or something, every once in a while, I'm asked to rate that Teams session with either one or five or everything in between, a couple of stars. Should we do something with that in end user computing or
absolutely. Yeah. I love that you took us there. I was going to answer it in a very generic, you know, images should be able to be built on demand to keep you happy. But you're right. At the end of the day, that doesn't matter. What matters is that we each have a different threshold of pain. Said simply, you and I have a different time at which I'll pick up the phone and call IT. Right? I mean, we know our way around a Windows box. Let's just be honest. We've been doing this for a while. And so the place at which Ingmar picks up the phone and calls IT is going to be perhaps radically more down the line than someone who can't figure out why they can't log in. It says, you know, hit the any key and I can't find it on my keyboard. This happens. This is a real thing.
There's that happened to me here.
Yeah. Yeah. I find it, you know, I've been looking for it for years. But the point is, I think for the gig economy, I want to go back to that notion of expectations. I, again, believe we will get there. I believe we will get to a marketplace of offerings in which the consumer, the end user, maybe not even the corporate, but the consumer, the person who's going to dedicate their time to do a job, I guess they're really the one that counts at the end, and they'll be able to select the instrumentality, the workspace, the platform that they believe they need to do that job. And yes, with some politics, and this is our corporate favor built into it, but it will never come before what they think they need to do their job. I mean, that's a radical thing to say. Well, no, you can have any kind of computer you want as long as it's a blank. I don't know. I don't think that's the model moving forward. I do believe that consumerization has broken that model very soon. I believe that users are still tolerating crappy machines, but not for much longer. I mean, and it's
our no. I think it's changing. Actually, while we were talking, I was
crappy on live air. I apologize to our.
That's fine. It's fine. Okay. You know, we were used to that. We tend to do that as well. I was actually moving away, grabbing a book. I was reading a book on SLA. I would say it's already outdated, and we're moving more to XLA. So it's more experience level agreements. Like, we can do metrics all day, and you can say, like, you know, login time has to be, you know, I don't know, sub 10 seconds.
Did you just make that up, XLA? I like that.
No, actually, I'll put it to the camera here. But I actually have a book on that. I did not write it. I'll send the link to you after.
Is it translated? Into the 20? Yeah, we need to get a translation of that. That's cool. No, keep going. Sorry, I interrupted you.
That's fine. No, awesome. You know, we do book reviews too here. But I think experience level agreements kind of make sense, right? Because we're talking about meeting users' people expectations, and that's diverse. I'm not sure how to measure it, but I think that's where we're heading to. And also, to me, the self-service thing kind of resonates because, you know, putting the power in people's hands that, you know, see what your experience is.
Yeah, I mean, this is so cool to talk to you folks because I can tell you right now, you just made me think of a real life example that happened last night at or around my house. A family member, I won't say who, has a job in technology and for the first time ever was literally talking to me about perhaps making a career change based on the fact that this other company would allow him to go move to, in this case, it was North Carolina, so he could go live with a bunch of his friends in this cool apartment and, you know, party a little bit. But how interesting that flexibility of where and how I could work, and to some point, or in someday in the future, what technology you give to me will absolutely choose where we end up going to work. I mean, he's like, I like this job I have right now, but if the new one lets me move here or work from there, why wouldn't I do it?
So I think that's going to open some eyes. Yeah, I highly recommend it. I have been to North Carolina a couple of times. I know a very great vendor that has an office in Raleigh. It's I so much enjoy being in Raleigh, but
it's
that's a way different
topic.
Actually,
where he's thinking about moving. We'll take that offline.
So I'm maybe switching gears a bit. I mean, obviously, we're talking about Liquidware. We're talking about Stratosphere. You are an entrepreneur. How would you say that you are different? What is your competitive difference or competitive edge in the market?
Oh, well, gosh, I would say, you know, from a Liquidware perspective, I'll give you three. And I practice this. So, you know, it's something that we talk about a lot. Well, people ask. And so what I typically like to say, you know, at least from my perspective, is it's the people at Liquidware. That's number one. The team here has multiple decades of experience together, having been at, you know, multiple organizations over the years. That's number one. Number two is the process, you know, the methodology. Oops, sorry, I'm getting a cold called here. Probably trying to sell me aluminum siding. Currently don't need any. Thank you very much. But the good news is that you have the people and then you have a process. You have a methodology. And so ours was simple. Assess, design, deploy, manage. If you got it wrong, do it over again. Assess, redesign, redeploy, you know, manage. And in the early days of VDI, that could be a 4 to 6 month long process. Today, it's weeks. And the third is the products. So we have great people here. That's our competitive advantage. I think we have a great process and we live it, that assess, design, deploy, manage. And then the products, which really from our perspective are born out of customers asking, hey, could you do this? And a lot of times, you know, those are where some of the best ideas come from. Personally, my competitive advantage as an entrepreneur, I don't require much sleep. It's just that simple. I really enjoy, you know, spending almost every conscious hour somehow engaged, you know, in or around these types of topics. And I think that's maybe something I've kind of made it a passion as well as a career. So I guess that would be my advice to any other entrepreneur. If you can have your passions and your career align, good luck. I don't think you're going to be hard to stop.
Actually, this is where we differ, Tyler. I need a lot of sleep. I just don't get it. But that's because I have young kids.
Oh, why are luckily out of the house, but I know the feeling very well. Absolutely.
So, but Tyler, you mentioned the people, the processes, and also the products of Liquidware, right? And we talked a little bit about Stratosphere, but there is more in the portfolio today, right? So can you tell us a little bit more on Profile Unity or FlexApp, or maybe even both?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, when we look at the portfolio, you know, Stratosphere has been a great foundational, you know, component over the last 12 years. But really, two of the, as you mentioned, the newer and kind of interesting elements are Profile Unity and FlexApp. I think of Profile Unity as the following. What if you could reach out and cut and paste everything that you cared about off of your PC and put it someplace very safe, very low risk, where it wasn't spinning around at 5,400 RPM on a hard drive made by the low cost bidder, you know, would that be interesting to you? What would you be able to do if your stuff wasn't landlocked to one physical device? And that's kind of the first notion of a universal profile. So I think of Profile Unity as enabling that universal profile. So whether you're at home today, in the office tomorrow, in the cloud the next day, using some type of an elastic multi-platform, don't worry how it's made, it's all going to work, environment, chances are that either you or your administrator will want some more robust user environment management than kind of comes out of the box, maybe with VMware or Citrix.
So you just mentioned flexibility and elasticity when we were talking about cloud and DAS. So would you say that Profile Unity could help achieve that, right? So we're like, to me, Azure isn't the right cloud solution. Let's move to AWS or maybe move to Alibaba, whatever cloud.
Yeah, we do a cool demo, Ingmar. I should dust this one off. But we do a really cool demo where, you know, we log in as a user in a physical environment in Denver, Colorado. Users working. We immediately log him off of that machine, provision a cloud-hosted desktop first time, AWS East. It's a data center outside of Virginia. And first time that machine has ever not only seen a human, but seen the user wouldn't know that that just happened. I'm on a different operating system, a different data center with a different stack of apps. Now, the other interesting thing is that I could make it different. I could apply different security when you work from home. You know, I trust you, Ingmar, but I really don't want you to be able to put that 2 terabyte USB drive in, you know, and maybe take the secret plans for the Death Star, you know, or, you know, something like this. Or maybe I don't want you to be able, you know, to print that, that novel that you've been writing. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that, you know, I want to maybe be able to have some degree of control over. Those are times when user environment management, you know, counts. Yeah. Adding to that is, I think you said elasticity, the elasticity of FlexApp, which is, hold on 1 second. Sorry, just getting pinged here on the side. But the power of FlexApp is the ability to make Windows applications natively portable. So not only can I make your Windows profile natively portable, meaning it can be contextually delivered no matter how or where if you log in, again, to Windows. Wouldn't it be cool if I could do the same thing with Windows applications? And so, you know, that's what we've done with FlexApp, the unique ability to put the binaries of an application in a network location so everyone can see them, everyone can get to them. And yet, for IT, I have the unique ability to flexibly, FlexApp, combine those in kind of a just-in-time, expectation-driven manner. So, yeah, it's it is actually, I would say, one of the more surprising upticks we saw was coming out of COVID. You know, I guess my expectation was, you know, the low-hanging fruit, you know, just let's get back to basics. Mm-hmm. A lot of folks are really tackling applications. You know, what's my app? I've heard the term application strategy used. I can't take credit for it. It's actually a former colleague of mine that used to use it. But application strategy, a lot of people are thinking about it now. What apps do I use? Why do I use them? And what would I change?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And actually, while you were saying this, I was thinking on an event that happened in France where actually an entire cloud data center burned down. I would say that having such solutions and portability would actually help in disaster recovery. But talking about failures, as in burning down a data center, I mean, shit happens.
Yeah.
You're an entrepreneur. You've got a software company. Where did you fail? I mean, obviously, you know, I think we mentioned this before in early recording on, you know, fail fast, fail a lot.
Sure.
Were there failures or was it just only success?
Oh, straight A's.
No, my gosh. I wish the story was that interesting, but it isn't. Well, maybe it's interesting, but it's not that good. What I mean by that is after we had a successful divestiture to VMware. I was part of an organization that was acquired by VMware late 2007, early 2008. I was one of the principals, so it was great. I then turned around and lost all of the money in 12 months by investing in a sports bar. So I started Liquidware below zero. A lot of people don't know that. I'm not ashamed to admit it.
Is this where the name comes from, Tyler?
I wish. Wouldn't that have been clever? I'm not that smart, but that would have been a great idea. I know I did tell you folks about my love for whiskey, so there's probably something in there if we were to double click. But no, I'm not proud of the failure, but you know what I learned? Pretty simple. It's temporary. You just keep going. I mean, you just keep going. It's going to be a long movie. There's going to be a lot of different scenes. Some will make you happy. Some will make you really bummed out. Some you can control and some you can't. And so, no, not all straight A's, not even close. As a matter of fact, I probably spent more time in detention and being asked to leave class than I actually spent in class. I actually didn't, find school too terribly difficult. Somebody asked me once how I did on my SATs. These are the standardized tests. I said, I did pretty well. They said, well, what did you get? And I said, not a perfect score, but pretty good. I had plenty of time. I was able to go back and check my answers a couple times. That always gets people chuckling. But I wish I could take full credit. Yeah. So anyway, I think that, you know, obviously, if you're not willing to fail, then you probably shouldn't step in the arena, you know, just to be honest. And not everyone has to. You have to be a little bit warped, perhaps, to put up with some of the stuff we put up with and, you know, makes it fun.
as long as we learn from the mistakes and are willing to share them with others, right? Just to prevent, as you mentioned at the beginning, right? Keep us out of the trees with rally riding. Oh, driving slow cars very fast.
Yeah. And thank you for so that we don't have to. I mean, I'd rather learn from other people's mistakes. I'll make my own, but you know, if people are willing to share, that's always good. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would tell you that 20-year-olds, cash and booze is a very bad business model. This is involving bars. So if anyone would like any free consulting, I can talk you out of doing that very quickly.
Well, at least it will add some very funny stories, right? But that's maybe for another episode in the future.
That will be our late night episode. We'll schedule that in the near future.
So Tyler, talking about sharing, right? So as a new tradition on our second season of the EUC Digest podcast, we asked our previous guest to ask a question to you without him knowing who he was asking the question to, right? And what the topic will be. So in our previous podcast, we had Barry Schiefer as our guest. He works at EG Innovations, which is just a coincidence, right? But he asked the question, and this is the question to you, and we ask you to answer it. When this whole pandemic thing is over, what is the third thing you will do? So obviously, first going to visit some family, and but the third thing.
Oh, gosh. Okay, so I'll give you one, two, and then I'll hover on three. So first is I have to go see my mom. My mom lives in a nursing home, and so I have not seen her in person in exactly 1 year and 1 week. And so I'm excited to go do that. So that's the first thing. She's just gotten her second vaccine, so we're fingers crossed getting close. Number two, I want to sit at a bar and have that whiskey that you and I miss because we don't see each other at VMworld or Citrix Synergy or Nutanix Next. The third, and this is going to sound small, I like smiling at strangers. I don't know why. I just do, because it's amazing that you can actually just do something so small and actually make someone else in a good mood. And I can't do that with a mask on. So I'm kind of excited to take my mask off. And I mean, sometimes I mean it. I just like sharing a smile. So it's a small thing, but I'm looking forward to that, man. So that's me.
Oh, wow. Great answer. I mean, there are no wrong answers, but this is a great answer.
Looking forward to one of those smiles face-to-face, in person.
I probably shave my beard, too. You'll be able to see my smile in this sort of
Well, just smile, Tyler. We don't have to.
That's right. We're just recording.
Sorry. Go ahead, Ingmar.
Yeah, I wanted to say, so Tyler, this is your turn. You got a question? No, it was a sneaky question, but I like it. It was a good question. This is now your turn to ask a question to basically the next guest for our podcast.
A little bit of pressure. I've thought about it. I wrote it down. I checked it twice, and mine goes like this. If you could go back in time and change one thing and only one decision that you've made, good or bad, what would it be? Only one.
An interesting question. Mm. Yeah.
Well, I'm happy to share that with the next guest because I have no answer.
Do you know what it is yet? So yeah, no, I'll be keen to see how they respond because I've actually thought about it myself. I
tune in to the next episode, Tyler. Yeah.
You've got me. Yeah. Subscribe.
Ingmar, I was already afraid that you would mention the bringing the hedgehog and the bats all together, right? At some market somewhere in the east.
Yeah, but that wasn't me. I mean, right? I mean, bringing in drones from the US to you without paying customs is one of those things. But no, I don't have a good answer yet. Yeah.
but Tyler, unfortunately, well, we can continue for many hours, obviously, but unfortunately we have to wrap up. And so I would like to take the opportunity to say thank you to all of our listeners. And we hope you enjoyed this snack as much as we did, as we try to serve you the right amount of EUC for your appetite. So Tyler, thank you very much for being our guest. And to all our listeners, thank you for tuning in today. And if you want to stay in touch, reach out. Please, I'm going to go record this, but if you have anything you want to add here or just want to stay in touch, reach out to us on our social channels or on email via podcast@eucdigest.com. Thank you very much for listening. Until next time.